Last evening I had somewhat more nastier migraine than usual, so, and it's still here a little bit, so I'm not at my, so to say, best, except in the sense that there's one who is not ill, and I assume you all know about that person. On that note, somebody said that, somebody asked, I think, Ancestor Dongshan, you know, oh yeah, that one who's not ill, does he take care of you? And of course, Dongshan says, no, I take care of him. So this is the heart of our cultivation. That unbusy one doesn't take appointments and also needs our undivided attention. So for me, if I'm very uncomfortable, as I was last night, there's always a temptation to turn oneself into two people. The uncomfortable one, and kind of another one, contemplating the uncomfortable one, wishing that one would get better. So this isn't undivided attention. In fact, that's sort of the mind of suffering. Even though the consciousness has the ability to kind of separate itself into sort of limitless entities. If we forget the meaning and the power of wholehearted contemplation, then we might get lost in amongst all those manifestations and decide that there is one who is sick and that one really should get better, because otherwise there's just misery. So please get better, Mr. Sick One. Whereas the wholehearted contemplation is not to seek for, would you mind getting some water? I'm sorry. Not to seek for wellness outside of this kind of sick place we're in. Sorry, I had to dispatch my faithful helper for some water. Make your pardon. So sitting practice is a way of, you could say, looking after the one who is not sick. And the way we look after that one is by not separating ourselves at all from him or her. Allowing this miraculous body-mind to manifest as it is, moment after moment, without trying to comb through all of the passing sand to grab some jewel or other. So this is the heart of not just Zazen or seated meditation, but the heart of practice, this undivided spirit. And the reason that's efficacious or important is because the spirit, if you like to use that word, is undivided. And to be practicing and living in accord with that reality leads away from misery. very much. So another area of manifestation of this true and undivided life, we call precepts. And I think properly seen, precepts are, you could say they are an elaboration, if you like, elaboration is not quite the right word I want. They are like a they are like zazen in a dance form, acknowledging the way in which we experience our lives as a constantly unfolding field of encounters and conditions and collisions and everything you can imagine. So the precepts are sort of like how to get along on the playing field. And my gymnasium down the street there, usually elite, they have like, I think, 8 enormous televisions hanging from the ceiling to entertain the patrons. And usually, mostly what's on there is pretty horrible, like reality TV, or that guy who brings these unfortunate couples on TV and then does a paternity test on and reads the results on stage. It's really terrible. And then at least 3 of them are on sports. And I noticed that there's some tendency to show if there's a like a fight on the field or on the ice, they tend to show it over and over and over again, like that's news. So you know, our lives can turn in that direction also if we're not careful. So we have these kind of regulations, like, well, you know, you may not agree with the umpire, but don't hit the umpire. Right? And if you're the manager of the team, you don't get to go out on the field and start hurling abuse at anybody, stuff like that. And we have some guidelines along those lines too. Some of the precepts particularly concern themselves with the karma of speech. So we know there are 3 manifestations of karma in body and speech and mind. Some of the precepts kind of orient themselves towards speech. And over the millennia, various people have commented at length on the precepts. Dogen has a very succinct collection of sayings about these precepts that we use when we do our full moon ceremony. So, precept number 4 is not to speak falsely. So that's obviously concerned with the karma of speech. And about that, Dogen says, the Dharma wheel turns from the beginning. There is neither surplus nor lack. The sweet dew saturates all and harvests the truth. So in this comment and in all of the others that Dogen makes, he's being careful to root our experience and understanding of the precepts in this undivided heart. As the, if you like, the the wisdom of that unbusy one, that one who is not sick, given flesh, right, manifesting in the world. So obviously, if we say, I vow not to speak falsely, that has some pretty clear and concrete applications. Dogen reminds us to put that against the background of vastness. He said, the Dharma wheel, the wheel of reality, the wheel of things as they are, has always turned. Always. Never too much, never too little. And that teaching, as we've heard, is like mist or dew. Right? And Dogen says it saturates everyone, makes everyone wet to the bone, not just to the skin, and not just to the bone, but to the marrow. And in so doing, harvests from us truth, right? Which is the only place it comes from, as you may have noticed. Draws what is true and real and honest forth from us in the midst of meetings with many other beings. So we take that vow. We vow with undivided heart and mind to speak straightforwardly. And we also know that straightforwardly isn't necessarily enough. It should also be non-injurious. True, certainly, insofar as we can see that. And under ideal circumstances, it would even fall gently upon the ear, but we can't always arrange for that. So the heart or mind of Zazen as speech is, I vow not to speak falsely. And then another of our precepts says, I vow not to slander. There should be no slander. Sometimes people sometimes think that never under any circumstances can you talk about some act or behavior on the part of some other people that was not so good. But that's not what the precept is about. First of all, slander is false. Something that is slanderous is not true. So that, we already rule that out. Sometimes we might be tempted to pass along some information about somebody that we think is true, but maybe we're not actually sure. So there we have to be very careful also. And about this precept, Dogen says, what does he say? He says, Christopher? Would you mind, behind you there, around the back, against that wall, in that plastic thing, there's a, I think it's the first thing in there. Does that look like precepts or a full moon ceremony?
It does.
Okay, so I think the page has got a little piece of paper taped on it. You can stay there, and if you would read that precept and Dogen's comment, the one about no slander.
Yes. I vow not to slander.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddha Dharma go together.
That's it. I got it. Thank you. Thanks for the cue. And the Buddha Dharma go together. appreciate together, realize together, actualize together. Don't permit fault finding. Don't permit haphazard talk. Do not corrupt the way. So, thank you, Chris. So we go, appreciate, realize, actualize as one body. Go just means, just our practice, day by day, side by side. We just go together. And in so doing, the appreciation of our life deepens and deepens to the point where it's no longer something we can grasp. And you could say, at that point, there may be some realization, which simply means the ringing truth of Buddha, the Buddha way, you feel in your own body. There may be, little or no intellectual content to that, just a sense in your own body of the truth of how things are. And that's also something we, so to speak, share, because it isn't someone's possession. And then together, we actualize that. That is, we bring that in, embodied into the world. And one of the ways we do that, or one of the dances, is precepts. So Dogen says, don't permit fault-finding. And I think all of us are, I won't speak for you guys, I certainly am familiar with the mind that is finding fault with various things, people, and circumstances. And I don't think Dogen's saying, well, you're not allowed to say that that's not so good and we should do that better. He's talking about the mind of fault-finding, which is a kind of habit, a kind of ongoing bitter criticism of really everything. We get right down to it. When you get into that mind, nothing is right. Everything is messed up. So Dogen's reminding us, don't invite that mind to take up residence. And one way that you can help that is by bringing this same kind of deep attention, affection even, to our own circumstances, our own bodily and mental conditions. And in so doing, we will also turn away from the mind that just kind of babbles, desultory, wandering, haphazard talk. Certainly gossip is included, but also just, talking endlessly about your latest find on eBay or something. I mean, it really doesn't matter. Again, what's important is the mind or the spirit behind it. So wandering, wasteful talk, veering in and out of perhaps, oh, not so good. That's not such a great way to talk about people, or maybe over in this other direction, we're speaking in a very inflated way about somebody. This is kind of wandering, haphazard talk. And even though the way, as Dogen says, the way is incorruptible, he's reminding us, even though you can't corrupt it, don't. Now don't allow our karmic circumstances to twist us away from the practice of the one who is not sick. And this adopting these guidelines for life will help us do that enormously. And as a result, our cultivation, our sitting practice will be more settled, which will enhance our understanding and practice of the precepts, and so on, round and round. And then there's one more precept that's about how we speak, the karma of speech, which is I vow not to inflate myself by deflating others. I vow not to praise self at the expense of others. So you might think, well, Buddhists wouldn't do that with their deep understanding of the nature of the self. Surely they would not. But well, sometimes they do, or we do. Sometimes we do. So Dogen has another little lesson, which is Buddhas and ancestors, kind of we call them that, if we call them anything, because they realize the vast sky and the great earth. So what does that mean? Well, that means they realize actual circumstances. He's not talking about cosmic states of mind. They're okay, because they're part of actual circumstances. But that's not what he's talking about directly. He's merely talking about mountains and rivers of this very moment. That's what Buddhas and ancestors realized. And he says, when they manifest the noble body, there's no inside and no outside. The noble body, the body of the Arya, which means the one who has entered the path. For one who has entered the path, the truth of emptiness is ongoing practice and verification. As I've said many times, probably too many times, the intellectual content of that actually isn't that difficult. Right? So if someone carefully explains to us the teaching of emptiness, that's not that much to grasp. It's much easier than, you know, quantum mechanics, for God's sake. But the verification of that in our own lives is, it responds to effort. It responds to our effort. And as that happens, as that unfolds, there's no inside, no outside, no self or other. Therefore, why would we inflate ourselves and diminish anybody else? Why would we do that? And then he says, when they manifest the Dharma body, the body of truth, there's not even an inch of earth to stand on. And what does that mean? That means everyone inhabits the same vast space. Not these people high, these people low. So that doesn't mean that, if somebody screws up, we can't take care of that. In fact, we must. For these precepts to have any meaning, as we say in the Jukai ceremony, they must be lived. Otherwise, they are useless. So that when there are difficulties in our practice, in our lives, we need to approach them, dealing with them open-heartedly and bearing in mind that practice and verification is the actualization of no self, no other. This is pretty critical for our practice, our understanding. And then, of course, related to how we talk is if we have some disagreeable feeling, and we kind of keep feeding that, then we're engaged in what's called harboring ill will. And I think we all have experience with that. I certainly do. It just means kind of wishing less than the best for someone. So Dogen suggests, instead of making a space in our body-mind for a little steaming cauldron of ill will, he says, very briefly, he says, not negative, not positive, neither real nor unreal. There is an ocean of illuminated clouds, an ocean of bright clouds. So once again, he is reminding us, turning us away from the eternally conflicted realm of self and other, and reminding us of reality. And saying, as he says elsewhere, just behold the universe with the eye of practice. All you will see is drifting white clouds. So when we are turning the wheel of ill will, it's good to remember this. And first of all, stop turning. Begin at the zero point of this body-mind. Bring forth the precepts all over again. And have profound trust, faith in practice verification. And as always, as we say, when you fall down, just get up right there, right on that spot. And so, as always, I ask that everyone join together. Join me, please, in this practice. And that's how worlds are transformed, just that way. Maybe you have some questions, comments.
That part about fault finding really resonated with me. There's certain situations bring sort of fire up that kind of mind, that fault finding mind, and it's almost like the neural pathways have started to make a rut in the road, so the energy always falls into that same pattern mm-hmm. over and over again. And the only way that I know how to work with that is when I see that happening, to acknowledge that that's what's happening, and then just go back to whatever it may be that is the task at hand. Mm-hmm. And but because it's such a rut, mm-hmm. over and over, no matter how many times you know, I try and bring myself back to mm-hmm. whatever's going on, that groove is still there.
Yeah, yeah.
And beyond, you know, coming back to the task at hand, I don't know how else to contend with that.
Well, that groove is called karma, basically. And you know, we can't just banish that. What we can do is practice in exactly the way you're talking about. Some people suggest the what you might call the antidotal approach. So if you're thinking harsh thoughts about someone, try to give rise to loving kindness instead. That's another way, and that's an interesting exercise in and of itself. But the most basic approach is exactly what you're talking about. The moment when you notice that, oh, there's that rut again, it's not that rut again anymore. It's something else. So although we might wish that, okay, I wish that such and such a feeling I would never have. I wish that too sometimes, but that's not very realistic. It's not in my case. As a hate type, I think I better not wait around for, angry, critical feelings to stop happening, because that I think that will probably never be. And in any case, Dogen's reminding us it doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to wait for that. As he says, body, mind, life, so forth, practice, all of that is an ocean of bright clouds. That's another way of talking about starting from zero again and again and again. And that effort is karmically transformative in the most significant way. So I would commend you to keep doing that. And
but I don't think I should be waiting around for a payoff.
No, I don't think so. Which isn't to say payoffs don't sometimes happen. It's just that... well, some of you maybe see the New Yorker magazine. There was a cartoon recently where featuring various Grim Reapers with the scythe and the hood and all. And one of them, the Grim Reaper is on somebody's doorstep, and so is the guy from Publishers Clearing House with his huge check. And Death is saying, oh, this is going to be awkward. So indeed, do not wait for the payoff, because someone else may arrive first. And this open, this just giving up of this effort, giving away of our effort freely is, Dogen would say, this is the practice of a verified Buddha. But don't worry about finding someone to stamp that for you. Just keep going. Yeah.
In my own experience, which I'm confronted with my own fault finding, judging, self
sure.
and other, mistaken view.
Yeah.
And as David talks about that compulsive like fault finding or flash of anger when someone bumps me, or I notice that there's a tension or a contraction.
Yep.
Even if it's just at the thought level. And so I can't do the anecdotal approach maybe later, but
mm-hmm.
initially it's just like, whoa, noticing
mm-hmm.
and then relaxing the body
yep.
and settling again, except that it keeps, you know, if I'm in the fire with something, I have to, you know, I have to sometimes
you
leave
to,
or,
yeah.
or just really just notice
mm-hmm.
and not speak.
Yes.
I notice that the fire that comes up when I'm upset,
uh-huh.
it wants to come into words.
Yes,
it's like,
of course.
It's very volatile. It's like a volcano. And it's
it
like,
can be, yeah.
That can just like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
My teacher also at one point said, it is like a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to sit on it. You know? You want to find a way for the lava to flow. Without taking out a village in the process. Yeah, exactly. And you're right, it's tricky. And yet, from what I see of the world, it's not just a worthwhile effort, but a critical one.
It's critical.
It's critical, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Chris?
This actually sort of relates back to last week. You
mm-hmm.
talked about how it's very difficult to know necessarily what is helpful or
mm-hmm.
how to help.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of how you would relate that along with today's topic and sort of encouragement
mm-hmm.
and sort of moving forward
mm-hmm.
with these sort of steps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as I said, Dogen says, go together. And knowing, you know, what's helpful for the situation is... again, that's another thing we shouldn't wait for. What is invariably helpful for the situation is for us to be upright and at home, whatever's happening. That's always helpful. And if some marvelously skillful intervention doesn't flow from that necessarily, well, that's okay. Being upright in the midst of phenomena, in the midst of flames, as our friend Fudo, Achalananta Raja, the knowledge king who is always practicing in the midst of fire, that's his or her practice. And to then do something that is obviously helpful, that people see and say, oh, that was helpful, that's fine. But the main point is this other of being at home and not squashing the volcano, being present for what's happening, and if necessary, being silent. And sometimes that won't work. Sometimes we'll speak. So there is no formula or plan that we can simply cast upon the world and figure out what's going to be helpful all the time. But we can trust this at-homeness. So that's what I would say. Do you have more questions? You want to pursue that?
No.
Okay. Jim?
Thank you, Mio, for your talk. I think some person, I'm speaking for myself, but with certain personality types and life experiences, I have a tendency to not express myself.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I feel like I don't have all the information. I'm not sure what truth is anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel my judging mind is doing its normal thing. So,
sure.
So I have a tendency to stuff it away.
Uh-huh.
And then it collects and stews and creates quite a pot.
Yep.
And
so you've noticed all this. That's excellent.
But I still don't know how to, I don't know whether it's confidence or just fear of being able to say something in the right words when
mm-hmm.
when the situation starts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to do that yet.
Yeah.
So
well, I don't either necessarily. You know, being upright at some point does mean letting people know what's up with us. And then where sentient beings sometimes get in trouble is our way of expressing what's up with us has an edge of aggression to it. So that sometimes when people, in my experience, over at the Zen Center there, you know, sometimes people would deign to offer you feedback. And it was obvious that the content wasn't as important to them as the fact that they could shake their finger in your face. That was kind of what was really happening for them. So to be aware that all I really want to do is shake my finger at that person is actually already very helpful, because then now that means actually I don't have to do that, because I've seen that rut, and maybe even my hand was on the way up. It's like, oh, okay, let's try something else, like, oh, I'm really irritated right now, you know, something. And this way of being ourselves is consistent with practice, I would say, and scary, makes us vulnerable. And we can make mistakes. If we're in a sangha, it's possible to make mistakes and recover from them. In a relationship that is, you know, where there's some real commitment to a depth that I would call spiritual, you can make mistakes and recover. In a fragile situation, usually not. Some people will catalog your mistakes till they have like a magic number, like 10, and then they kick you out. It's like, so all of those opportunities went away, and all that was left was the fragility of the situation manifesting itself as a broken connection. So sometimes that's going to happen. And yet our responsibility to speak truthfully and as much as possible without aggression, it still remains with us. Doctor, do you have a comment you would like to share?
Oh, yeah, I think there's
there is some, you know, maybe some emphasis in, you know, this tradition of being introspective and thinking, you know, oh, I need to manage this situation, I need to handle the situation. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty involves, of course, you know, your reality and another person's reality.
Yes.
And, you know, you're probably not going to agree.
Probably not.
You know, if you've gotten this far to have that state of conflict, you're probably not going to find that you can just, you know, people are always managed or saying, oh, take him out to lunch, take her out to lunch. You know, it's almost never that simple in my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think as part of it is just the amount of time it takes, you know, to actually meet another person and, you know, find out where your differences are and try and find a way in which you can move forward together in ways that are not threatening to either one of your reality.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just don't have the time.
Well, then is that because something else is calling for our attention?
Yeah.
Yeah, something more urgent?
Yeah.
Yeah. There we are. Yeah. 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 Still, with a little luck, there may be other opportunities down the road, just little things that we can, occasions where we can actually let some light into the situation. And that will make a difference. That is my experience. It does make a difference. And Suzuki Hoshi tells us even a little difference is very important. And looking at our world today, I would have to agree. Well, I think we have a little event upstairs. Somebody's having a birthday. The one who is not sick is having a birthday today. And you're all invited. So please join us. Okay. Oh, and next week, I think Jana Draka is giving the talk, I think, next week. And don't forget, the retreat is coming up on the 6th?
7th.
7th of December. And it's been a pretty much a sick week for me. So there's a lot I haven't gotten done, among other things. I haven't put the schedule up. But I will get to that as soon as may be. And you're welcome to come and join any period of sitting you want to. It's best if people don't wander in and out during a period, but you can come in and join any period you like without signing up for anything, unless you plan to be at a meal, in which case we need to know about that in advance. Okay, yes?
So this is an Occupy Harper Street Zen Center event?
Yes. We are going to occupy Harper Street Zen Center. Yes. Thank you very much. May our intention be